Welcome to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Each episode of Keep Calm and Cook On features a meaningful interview and answers to listeners' questions about cooking. Thanks for tuning in. Hi, and welcome to a special bonus episode of Keep Calm and Cook On. A couple of weeks ago, I got to interview the cookbook author Priya Krishna live in New York as part of her book tour for her new cookbook, Indian-ish, which she co-authored with her mother, Ritu Krishna. I got to record our conversation to share with you all as a special bonus episode. First, a little background. Indian-ish is Priya's loving tribute to her mom's quote-unquote Indian-ish cooking. It's a trove of one-of-a-kind Indian-American hybrids that are easy to make and practical and packed with flavor. Think roti pizza, tomato rice with crispy cheddar, and whole roasted cauliflower with green pea chutney. Priya's mom taught herself to cook after moving to the United States while also working as a software programmer. Her recipes merge the Indian flavors of her childhood with her global travels and inspiration from cooking shows, as well as her kids' request for American favorites like spaghetti and peanut butter and jelly. I love Indian-ish not just because it's a collection of well-tested recipes, but also because it's so much about taking pride in where and who you come from. Reading it encourages me to consider the people and dishes that make me who I am, and I hope it has the same effect on you. In addition to Indian-ish, Priya is also a regular contributor for The New York Times, Bon Appetit, The New Yorker, and she also has a video series on Bon Appetit's YouTube channel. I really hope you enjoy our conversation. Writer to writer, how do you keep track of everything? And what is your spreadsheet situation for your freelance career?
I have a big time spreadsheet situation.
Like, what are the columns? What are the...
No, I can tell you because when I started freelancing, someone sent me their spreadsheet and I like created a spreadsheet based off of their spreadsheet. It's like, basically I like set myself, I feel like this is going to make me sound insane. I give myself like a salary and I divide it by 12 and that's like the monthly goals that I have to hit. Like every month. And so I have like, it's broken up by month and then it's like publication or company and then like the due date, then the amount they're paying me. And then I say like whether there's a little checkbox whether I've invoiced them and whether I've been paid or not. But it's like, it's kind of gone off the rails in coming year and like in the past few years because like, I don't know, like my like income streams have changed and it's just all gotten a lot more like discombobulated, but like I could be better about being on top of things now that you're saying this.
No, I bring it up because I am genuinely curious. I also really relate to what you say. I transitioned this year. This was a big deal. I went from a literal post-it on my desk that said money I'm owed to a spreadsheet. So I feel really grown up about that. But I think so often when we talk about food writing and food writers and we hear things, big titles like The New York Times, The New Yorker, and having your own book and stuff like this, there's so many logistics behind this work.
Yes.
And I think one thing that I think freelance writers have in common with home cooks is that you're in charge of all of it. So a home cook doesn't have someone, you know, preparing your vegetables for you and washing the dishes. You're doing the whole thing. A freelance writer, you're running your own kind of small business. So I always like to talk to writers about those logistics.
No, I mean, when I started, like my career is like, I owe greatly to all of the writers who shared their spreadsheets and templates and like, just like means for keeping track of it all. Cause it's a pain.
Do you pay it forward? Is your spreadsheet available?
Yeah, I will happily share any documents with anyone.
So I wanted to start with, to really start talking about your book with some questions that you actually laid out in your book and answered directly. And I think they're really important questions that kind of set the framework for the book. So this is almost a pop quiz for you based on your own writing. But I'm going to ask you, four questions. One, Priya, why should I make Indian food at home?
I think that Indian food is one of the most sort of like simultaneously nutritious and flavorful cuisines out there. The food that I grew up with is just, it's really wholesome. It's mostly vegetarian. It's, you know, not that hard to make, but every recipe has like a really cool trick that you can apply to other recipes. And you know, I read a New York Times article that said it's one of the most sustainable cuisines out there because of all the legumes. I feel like legumes are like criminally underconsumed in the United States. Like I literally have an entire shelf of my cabinet that's just lentils in Ziploc bags. I feel like we should all eat like that.
I was about to say, who else? Yeah. okay, number two, why aren't there any curries in your book?
I hate the word curry as it's used in Indian food. I feel like it's just this like awful word that was kind of perpetuated by European colonizers to kind of reduce Indian food to this monolith when in fact it's super, super diverse. You can go from, you know, Kerala to Punjab and feel like you're in a completely different country, maybe even a continent. And so that word curry has just done such a disservice mm-hmm. to our food. Like I like the number of people who've been like, I don't like Indian food because I hate curry. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? And curry has become this like, when I think of curry, I think of this sort of like meat floating in a gravy you're served at a lot of Indian restaurants. But that's not the reality. That's like a very specific aspect of Indian food from a very specific time in Indian history that doesn't really speak to what most people are cooking at home.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're passing the test. number three, I thought this was an amazing question that you asked and answered in the book. So I'm going to ask you as a person buying your cookbook,
yeah.
Investing my time to read it, my money, spending to buy the book. Why should I trust you?
This is all from this fake FAQ I generated in the book. I read about it. I read a fake FAQ in Mindy Kaling's memoir as everybody hanging out with me and other concerns. And I just thought it was the most wonderful thing. Like, I love being able to control your own. Well, I guess FAQ is by definition controlled, but I just like, I just get asked so many annoying questions about this book and about Indian food.
So you made one place to refer people to, so you never have to talk about it.
Yeah.
But now I'm going to ask. Just wanted to clear that up.
Why should you trust me? I think the first level of it is that you should trust my mom. My mom is just an unbelievably intuitive cook not only is she an intuitive creative cook, but like she is an intuitive creative cook with limited time. So I feel like her recipes are this really wonderful and rare combination of, you know, simple and time-saving and really flavorful and really different. So like, I think you should trust me first and foremost because my mom wrote 100 recipes and my mom is like a culinary genius as far as I'm concerned. And as a food writer, you know, you meet lots of different chefs and lots of different home cooks. And I still feel like I come back to my mom at our home in Dallas. And I'm like, she is an exceptional cook by any standards. The second thing is I worked really, really hard on these recipes. My mom wrote them. I moved home for a month to test them. And then I did this crowdsourced recipe testing system in which I got 3 amateur cooks to test each of the recipes in the book. And I basically cut the ones that got mixed reviews. And this was like greatest hits only. So it's definitely one of those situations where, you know, I worked really, really hard to make sure these recipes are bulletproof. And I myself, like, admittedly, I am a lazy cook. I'm not someone who on a Tuesday night will be taking on some big project. I want something that is quick, that is flavorful, that will fill me up. And this book is all of that. Like, I would not put something in here unless I would make it on a Tuesday.
What did you have for dinner last night? Was last night Tuesday?
Yeah. Was last night Tuesday? Where was I last night? I was in Philadelphia. I did an event at Drexel University, and the students of Drexel made food from my book.
Wow.
So I ate food that they cooked from my own book. And it was really funny because I went into the event, and I had eaten like sag feta, this dish from my book, like 6 nights from the previous week. And I was like, I hope that they don't serve sag feta because I love that dish, but like I can't eat any more of it. And then they were like, we made a big vat of sag feta. And then I got home and I was really hungry and I opened our freezer and I had like frozen a batch of sag feta. It's like, I can't escape this dish. But you know what? I ate it yesterday and it was really good.
Great. I was really struck by 2 things at the kind of bookends of your book. Mm-hmm. So in your acknowledgments, you thank your editor for, I wrote it down, betting on a book about a weirdo and her family. and then you also even thank your haters to get their own section. You said, I took all those tough times and turned them into a writing career. And in your introduction, I was so moved by when you said all the things that made me the awkward kid in school who didn't eat and dress like everyone else, those have become my strengths as a writer. At some point, that deep shame and desire to hide who I was morphed into something resembling confidence. And I don't know if it's because I am a little bit obsessed with Brené Brown. Anyone else? Yeah, watch the net? Okay, a couple. But this idea of... this sort of transformation of shame mm-hmm. that I think is so much of what your book is about. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about at what kind of point that happened. Was it sort of a light bulb moment? Was it slowly over time?
It was slowly over time, and it happened really late for me. I went to both my high school and my college were predominantly white environments. Like, I remember, like, even in college, I was the captain of my school's Bollywood dance team. And I had these friends who were not Indian who really wanted to join the team. And so they joined the team, and all the Indians in the Bollywood dance team got really upset that I had like brought white people into the Bollywood dance team. And so they like in protest started a rival Bollywood dance group that was Indians only. It's like, yeah.
I was about to ask when the movie's coming.
And so I just like had this very bizarre, it was just this very bizarre experience where like throughout my life, I felt like I was not American enough for the Americans and not Indian enough for the Indians. I sort of existed in this weird in-between, and it lasted for such a long time to the point where like, you know, I wasn't talking openly about Dal Chawal or, you know, Bollywood music with people. And then when I became a writer and, you know, I had just quit my job, I had to pay the rent. Like the first thing I went to was Indian food because that's what I knew. And I realized that there was a gap in food media of, you know, Indians writing about Indian food, mm-hmm. talking about Indian home cooking, talking about, you know, things that are unique to the Indian American experience, like, you know, obsessively picking out mangoes or making homemade yogurt. And that, you know, I could be someone who filled that gap. And it was weird at first. I didn't want to be sort of put into a box, but it was also one of those things where I realized I was mostly mining my childhood mm-hmm. memories. I was calling my parents and like interviewing them for stories. I was co-bylining with my mom and my dad. And that's, you know, I found a group of friends who were all other Indian American women. It was the first time I'd ever had a group of women who looked like me and had upbringings like me. And I feel like, you know, it only happened like from like 2016 onward. Like even I worked at the food magazine Lucky Peach, and like we didn't write about Indian food much at all. And when we did, it was, we had like this one, I love him, but we had like this one white guy and he wrote about the Indian food. And it just, I don't know, it really, it. I think it, I'm realizing now how much it bothered me
yeah.
then.
And that moment when you kind of saw this gap, were you, did you feel or sense that gap because you were looking for those stories just as an individual to kind of read, or were you kind of looking for a gap for yourself as a writer to fill, or it was simultaneous?
Honestly, it was like I needed to pay the rent and like, yeah. what stories do yeah. I have that that editors will yeah. respond to? And the Indian stories were what editors immediately responded to, because I think they started to realize like, oh, people haven't pitched us this before. This is something unique and different. And she can, you know, at first it was things like a guide to Indian condiments or like Indian egg dishes, like mm-hmm. really simple stuff.
Like a listicle.
Yeah. yeah. Like, you know, what is a dosa? Things like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as time went on, I started to realize like, okay, yeah, I could become, you know, an ambassador for Indian cooking. Not that ambassadors are very different from expert. I definitely don't consider myself an expert on Indian cooking, but at least I could use my experiences to try and make food media a little more inclusive.
Yeah. And you, I'm so moved by that position you take, I feel like, with your book and your work in general, because I mean, I feel like you very much write what you know, and what you know is being your mother's daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
totally.
Making that. So you kind of talked about that group of friends that you found, and I wanted to know about during this kind of sort of shame transformation shift time, your support system. And it sounds like that has been a big part of it. Was that, how did that come about? Were you reaching out to them? They were reaching out to you?
Well, so the first person in this sort of group, it was someone who my mom connect. It was like one of those things, you know, when your mom connects you with someone and they're like, you should meet this person. And you're like, mom.
She likes food. Yeah. Great mom.
Yeah. And I was just like, fine, I'll meet her. And then we met and it was just like, we immediately clicked. We talked all night. We took the subway back home. Like, it was just like this like immediate connection. And then we realized we both knew this other Indian girl, and that Indian girl knew another Indian girl who she knew at work. So the four of us just started getting dinner. And what was really funny was at the time, this friend was a restaurant critic. And she, like, we, the four of us, would go out to dinner when she was reviewing restaurants. And she was just like, it's so hilarious because like the last group that any restaurant is like looking out for is like a group of Desi women at a restaurant. And like even when we'd order like bit like over order, like never once did anyone even like look twice at us. And what was really funny is I remember the four of us went to this one restaurant that I won't name, and we were told it was like a 15-minute wait, and it was pouring rain outside, and we were like, okay, we'll wait in this like little threshold. It's just 15 minutes, and they're like, oh no, you have to wait outside. And we were like, it's pouring rain, and they were like, you are gonna have to wait outside. And I wanted to have one of those like Pretty Woman, Julia Roberts moments where I was like, you've made a big mistake. Huge.
Do you know who this is?
Yeah, do you know who she is?
So what happened? You waited?
We waited. Well, what happened was we started walking to a bar and then sat down at the bar and we're about to order drinks. And then they called us being like, your table's ready. And we were like, we knew this was going to happen.
Wow. And that group is still a pretty big part of your life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I don't know what I would do without them. Like, it's mostly like a text thread, but mm-hmm. it's also just like an emotional support group. I never realized how important it is. You know, it's important to have a really diverse friend group, but it's also really important to just like have people who really understand like the uniqueness of sort of your specific experience, mm-hmm. being able to talk to them about like, you know, the Priyanka Chopra Nick Jonas wedding and like the latest Bollywood song and like, you know, to send each other, like we all follow all of these, like we follow all of these like bridal Lehenga boutique Instagram accounts. And so it's mostly us just like sending each other bridal Lehengas that we like and just things like that. Yeah. Like they're really small, silly things, but it also like whenever we are told by an editor, like, you know, like we'll never publish a recipe with curry leaves. Mm-hmm. Like we can kind of vent to each other and seek advice on how to handle those situations.
Yeah. I feel like it's all those texts that are about things that are not important is that's this kind of webbing that holds you together for those moments when you do need each other. And I feel like it's like talking about your spreadsheet at the beginning. I mean, these are small details of your kind of everyday life, but I think they build up to something really important that we can all relate to. So you kind of experience these feelings as a kid. You described yourself as the awkward kid. You kind of got in touch with sort of what you know, which is mm-hmm. your family, your experience. You have this group of friends. You have transformed this feeling of shame. And so I'm wondering now what role confidence plays in your life. And specifically, do you ever feel imposter syndrome? And do you play the comparison game? And I'm asking for a friend.
All of the above. Literally all of the above. Like I constantly going into every single article that I write for any publication, I think that I'm not good enough. And I like had to stop myself from, I used to send drafts to my editor at the Times being like, I'm not sure how I feel about this graph, but I hope you like it anyways. And I was just like, nope, I'm just going to be like, here's my story. Like looking forward to your notes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I feel imposter syndrome every day and I always compare myself to other people. It's really, really bad. But like, especially as a cookbook author, like I'm not gonna like not gonna lie. I kind of like one thing that I've done to just cope with it is like just mute a lot of people on social media.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's like a way of not, you're not like specifically throwing shade at them, but it's just like for my own mental health.
Oh, it's not about them.
Yeah. It's just like, I just don't want to see what you're doing because I don't want to compare myself to you. And it doesn't seem to me like a petty thing. It's just like, it just like, I can't be petty if I don't see it.
Yeah. You know? No, it's a mental health thing. I mean, that was going to be my piece of advice. So I discovered that mute button. It's great. I've done it with family. Like, it's really...
It's just great.
It puts you in the control seat. And you can look if you want, but it's on your terms.
Yeah.
And you're not... It's not just appearing.
And I'll, like, mute and unmute people.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just... It's great. And, like, I don't know. I wouldn't mind if someone muted me. If, like, another author muted me for a period like that. I'm like, I feel like during book tour, authors are like the most annoying on their social media accounts. So
because we sort of have to be.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't, but we feel like we do.
I was at dinner with my relatives the other day and they were just like, we used to like your Instagram. And it's like, oh my God.
That was a question I was curious about because you, you know, your book is, you've done it with your mom, your family plays such a big part in your work. You've written articles with your parents. Yeah. Your family is such a big part of your work. And I'm wondering about, is there a feedback process with your kind of family and your closest friends? Like, do you hear, you're talking about sort of feedback from your editors and stuff. It sounds like your family's pretty forthcoming.
I send stuff to my family a lot, especially when I'm writing about Indian food to just sort of gut check. Mm-hmm. I send stuff a lot to like members of this text thread or even like when I'm about to post a Bon App video and if there's like something I'm saying about Indian cuisine, I'll like send that clip to them being like, is this a generalization? Is this a fair thing to say? It's really, really nice having a sounding board. I feel like the one thing that I don't suffer, like imposter syndrome, check, like comparison, check, but I don't really have an ego when it comes to edits for things.
Like you mentioned when you sent stuff to your editor, you said looking forward to your comments, and I was going to ask, are you really looking forward?
I feel like the one thing that I've gotten really good at is just like taking edits, and I don't take them personally. Like I have a group of editors who just, I know, I just like, I've worked with them for 2.5 years now, and I know that they like genuinely, they think I'm a good writer, and sometimes I submit copy that's really great, and sometimes it needs some work, and I just have just learned to kind of trust in the process. I mean, and a part of that comes with like finding editors that are really great and that you trust, but yeah, like I feel like I've never been like stung by tough edits before.
Yeah.
That's like one thing that I feel I'm okay at.
Yeah. I feel like that is, it's like a line that is where you're reminding yourself this is your job. And it's like, and it's a professional thing. Both you and I write about things that are really personal. So sometimes I know I have a hard time not taking certain things personally, but when it comes to the actual writing and comments on that, like it can be so helpful. Do you feel like the people you're handing your work into are familiar with what you're writing about?
I think now they are because I talk about it so much.
They're familiar because they're editing your work.
Yeah.
Separate from that.
Yeah. And they like know my universe by now. Like I'm thinking about my editor at the Times and my editor, Bon Appetit. Like I feel like they know a lot about Indian cuisine because they've edited me writing about Indian cuisine so much now.
Do you have any desire to hand in work to an editor who has more knowledge than just beyond your...
I would love to, but the reality is, I mean, I was in a conversation the other day where someone was like, how many editors of color have you ever had? And for me, it's two. Mm-hmm. I've had two editors of color, and I've written for a lot of publications. That's like pretty remarkable. And now I work with far fewer editors, and I'm pretty sure all of them are white. And I think one thing that's really tough is that most publications that I write for, the sort of baseline perspective is that you are white. You like read these magazines and it's the assumption is that like you are white and you're white. And so the idea of cooking with coriander seeds is foreign to you. And so they'll write things in a way like this recipe comes with like an unexpected ingredient, like cardamom pods. Mm-hmm. Whereas like I've had cardamom pods stockpiled in my fridge for as long as I can remember. And I think that, you know, the way to change that is to hire people of color and not just hire people of color, but hire them in senior level positions and make them the gatekeepers. And I think one thing that really impresses me about someone like, you know, say Tejal Rao at the Times is that like she is in a position of power. She's the restaurant critic for California. And instead of just like sitting there in her position of power, she has worked to bring on tons of contributors of color to New York Times food. Like that section feels completely different than it was before she joined. And I feel like she's a big part of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've always thought, like, as I get more and more platforms, like, okay, how can we, like, open the doors for other people to succeed? And, you know, I'm not an editor. I'm not able to assign things, but even if I can just, like, put people mm-hmm. on people's radar, but it's tough. Like, it's really, really tough. Like, even, like, I feel like at least at the publications I work for, like, people will listen to me, but people just, what they don't understand, they're more hesitant about.
Do you have any desire to be an editor? Is that something on your mind?
Or I don't think so. No. I think that I'm, like, definitively a better writer than I am uh-huh. editor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just curious.
Yeah, no, I...
And do you... I feel like everything you're talking about kind of makes me think about... I mean, I'm just a huge believer that no one person speaks for any entire community.
Yeah.
And, you know, Indian cooking, Indian American cooking, Vietnamese grilling, whatever it might be, you know, there's a million stories within each of those, you know, and no community is a monolith. But I'm wondering if you, because, you know, you saw that kind of gap just a couple of years ago, there are a few other kind of prominent writers, but not a ton, kind of in that gap that you're standing in.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you ever feel any pressure to kind of represent more of the diaspora beyond just your family.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I don't just write about Indian food. I try to find stories of people and places that are underrepresented. And for me, that can mean like a city like Salt Lake City that doesn't get touched by the food media. Mm-hmm. It can mean covering immigrant communities. It can mean covering the LGBTQ mm-hmm. population. But I just try to, like, in my writing, bring something that didn't previously exist before. Mm-hmm. Like, I love being, like, the first person yeah. to interview someone.
How has making this book changed your relationship with both your parents, if at all?
I don't think it has. I thought it would. Mm. It really did. Mm-hmm. Like, my mom and I have never been best friends. I think there's this, like, Western sense that you have to be, like, Rory and Lorelai mm-hmm. from the Gilmore Girls. Mm-hmm. But my mom and I were never like that. She traveled a ton for work. She wasn't around a lot. She was sort of this, she was very much an authority figure and not a friend. And I think I've just come to realize that I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's totally fine for your mom to just be someone who you look up to and who's a role model, but who you aren't, like, sharing your deepest, darkest secrets with. And I kind of thought that, like, maybe we would become like pals.
Do you think that a goal for you in making
the
book?
No, it was sort of like something that was just in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
But, like, my mom treated the book like she treated any assignment at work. Like, she project managed me. And honestly, like, I didn't hate it. Like, it was really nice working with someone who was super organized, on time, like, great with deadlines. Like, it was...
Yeah, is she available? Yeah.
It was just fantastic. So, you know, I, like, realized that, yeah, we don't have, like, a best friend relationship. And in fact, the relationship that we've always had works really well in this setting. And my dad has always been, like, that, like, quiet, but, like, also super goofy guy who just kind of, like, does all of this stuff sort of not even like without being asked. Like, when I was recipe testing, my dad would sort of, like, a ninja come into the kitchen and do the dishes and then go back into his office. So they just, like, assumed those roles. And then my dad was, like, this, like, amazing goofy figure who wrote one of my favorite parts of the book, which is his essay on why his yogurt is fabulous.
Which was also the subject of, you got to write a huge profile of your dad.
Yeah.
For the Times.
Yeah.
And how, like, how is that received? Like, is he sending you a text of himself with the paper? Like,
yes, he did send me a text of himself with the paper. He was really excited. He said he was at, like, a hotel for work, and he said someone recognized him at the hotel, which was huge. I think this was a mistake, but I framed the article and sent it to him as a birthday gift. And now when you, like, walk into our house, it's like he put it really prominently right in the front. And he's just so excited. And my mom called me and was like, I can't believe you wrote about your dad in the New York Times.
Well, I feel like they evened out.
Yeah, no, I think they evened out. My mom is like a lot more chill about the attention.
Yeah.
Whereas like my dad is featured very prominently in my Bon Appetit videos. And he, like every WhatsApp group that he's a part of, he is sharing these videos and being like, I appear at 5 minutes and 35 seconds.
Don't even watch the whole thing. That's amazing. Let's get to the good stuff. That is so funny. You are really in, you're like in the kind of like newlywed moment. Mm-hmm. Of putting a book out. It's really recent. It's just a few weeks ago. So it might be too early to ask you this, but I'm wondering, having made it and now getting to go around and talk to lovely groups of people such as yourselves about it and stuff, has making this book shifted your goals at all as a writer?
Yeah, I think I always thought that the end game was just like being a journalist who wrote really amazing stories, and sometimes they would involve Indian food, but just... Yeah, like I just wanted to be a traditional journalist, but I think I've come to the realization that like I, in some, maybe I can, you know, be someone who helps bring Indian cooking into the mainstream. And I think there are already some really amazing people who are doing that, like Tejal and like Khushbu Shah and like Sonia Chopra. But, you know, I feel like the more of us there are who have platforms, like we might as well use them. And Indian food is what I know. I literally have just like written a book of these recipes, and you know, after doing these Bon Appetit videos, you realize that like there is such an appetite for like Indian food as home cooking, and just like generally non-Western food as home cooking. So you know, I'd love to figure out some way to just keep doing that, and I don't know if that means some more cookbooks or something else, but yeah, I think that's, I equally want to be like an investigative journalist as I want to be like a, you know, Indian home cooking evangelist.
Yeah. You can wear two hats.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, you're doing it. You're actively doing it.
Trying really hard to do it.
It's great. Has anyone here gotten the book yet? Yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. A lot of you. I have one more kind of writer question I'm so curious about. Are you thinking of anyone when you're writing?
What do you mean?
Like, are you thinking about, do you have a reader in mind? A specific person or a type of person?
For my book, I did. For my book, I was thinking a lot of my brother-in-law, David.
Uh-huh.
He is not Indian, but he does. He's my sister's husband, and he does most of the cooking. And my sister craves Indian food, and so he tries really hard to make her.
And he's not Indian.
He tries really hard to make her Indian food. And so I was thinking, like, okay, like when David gets home from his job, like how can I explain this to him in a way that he'll understand? And in fact, a lot of people in our family have married non-Indian, so my mom was like, yeah, think of David, think of like my cousin Raghav's wife Tatiana, like my cousin Rohit's wife Kime, like mm-hmm. all of them coming home from work and like wanting to make Indian food, like write this book for them. So yeah, I feel like those are the people that I was thinking of. That's when awesome. I was writing this book.
I love that. My person always is my mother-in-law. Mm. And I feel like kind of similar stuff, like she's busy. She doesn't want to take a lot of time, but she wants to make something that people are going to like remember.
Right.
Post on Facebook. That's a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
But it's like she doesn't want to spend a ton of money or like, yeah.
For me, David has always been my ultimate voice of reason. Like he is just like the most wonderful human being. We overlapped in college together for 1 year when he was dating my sister. And we like co-wrote a paper together, and he was the only one I let read my college papers before I turned them in. So I just feel like like if he gives something the seal of approval, then
it's meaningful.
It's good. Yeah.
Is David here?
No, David's not here. I wish he. I'm going to send him this podcast so he knows.
Amazing. This is dedicated to David. I have so many more questions for you, but mostly I just want to say I think you've made an amazing book. It's really cool to see it out in the world, to know people are cooking from it. And then my final question I'm going to ask, because I just wanted to leave plenty of time for all of you to ask Priya whatever you'd like. But my final question, which is just my favorite question to ask, and I'm so curious because you basically wrote a book on this, but what was your favorite food to eat when you were growing up? Like, first thing that comes to mind.
Tex-Mex. Like, yeah. I had an order at Mi Cocina, which was my local place.
And what was the order?
It was cheese enchiladas, double rice, no beans. And then I would put the rice like on the enchiladas so they kind of looked like a porcupine. So you got like rice encrusted enchiladas. They're really good.
You're sitting there eating it like with your family or you're taking it to go?
Sitting and eating it with my family.
You drinking anything?
Well, when my sister gave me her old driver's license, I would order margaritas. But otherwise, I was just drinking water. But it was very exciting when I could order underage margaritas. Yes.
That is an exciting day. I love that answer. That's not what I was expecting. That is awesome. I guess you can take the girl out of Texas. But thank you so much. This is really great. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Keep Calm and Cook On. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you have a few extra seconds, please rate and review the show. It really makes a difference to help others find it. And let someone know about it. Post about it on social media, text a friend about the show, email your family. It all adds up. Keep Calm and Cook On is produced and hosted by me, Julia Tertian, and engineered by David Tatasciore. For more about David, head over to davetat.com. And for more about me and my work and my cookbooks, head over to juliatertian.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter @Tertian. Thanks again for listening.